Welcome to this ordinary general meeting, and in particular, welcome to guests of members, and in particular, it's lovely to see Patricia here. Welcome indeed. Copies of the minutes of the last ordinary general meeting held on the 22nd of September have been displayed on the Institute notice board and will be taken as read. May I sign the minutes as a correct record? Yes?
Yes.
Where are they? Here they are. Now, it's one of my very pleasant duties is to welcome our recently elected honorary fellow, Professor Chris Rogers, to this meeting. Professor Chris Rogers is Professor of Statistical Science at Cambridge University. He heads the Quantitative Finance Group in the Statistical Laboratory. His main area of work is in the theory and applications of probability, with particular emphasis on mathematical finance. Chris is the principal organizer of the Newton Institute Programme on Financial Mathematics. He is co-author of the leading two-volume manuscripts, Diffusions, Markov Processes, and Martingales. The actuarial profession is very pleased to have strengthened its links with such an influential figure in the world of financial mathematics and with Cambridge University. We are delighted indeed that Chris has accepted our invitation to be an honorary fellow of the Institute. I shall now come round here. You stay where you are for a moment. This is a bit of an itinerant meeting because I'm also delighted to welcome, and he just told me how to pronounce his surname, Anthony Cockburn. No? Colin. Cochran. Thank you.
Cochran.
Anthony is the inaugural winner of the Watson Wyatt Prize for Financial Economics, awarded to the best performing student in subject 109, the financial economics paper. The award of this prize has been made possible by Watson Wyatt LLP, offering to provide sponsorship to the profession. In addition to providing the prize, Watson's will also sponsor other educational work undertaken by the profession. And Paul Thornton would like to say a few words.
Thank you, Jeremy. Financial economics was first introduced into the education syllabus in the year 2000. Reflecting a rapid rise in interest in the subject, signalled by numerous debates and papers in recent years. It's fair to say that ideas from modern finance theory, however, were being used well ahead of that by the Maturities Guarantees Working Party in the 1970s, by David Wilkie in numerous papers that he's written over the years, by Andrew Wise in his papers on matching assets and liabilities in the mid-1980s. But nevertheless, I do feel the professions tended to be rather insular and rather disinclined to look outside its boundaries for ideas from others. And it's a point I made in my presidential address 5 years ago, almost to the day. And I'm pleased to say that I do detect a significant change in attitude. The introduction of honorary fellows and affiliates has been highly important. But perhaps the most significant change is only really come home to roost with changes in the education syllabus. Furthermore, financial economics is a rapidly moving subject, and we'll need to ensure we keep up to date with the latest thinking. Indeed, a certificate in finance for liability actuaries is being introduced in January 2004 to enable those of us who haven't had the privilege of sitting subject 109 or 305 to catch up. So, one way or another, financial economics is a very important subject for the profession to teach. And speaking on behalf of Watson Wyatt, I'm delighted that we are associated with such an important area of change in the profession. And I would like to congratulate Anthony Coughlin for being the first winner of the Watson Wyatt Prize for Financial Economics.
And Paul, may I add my thanks to Watson's for inaugurating this this prize. I expect it. Thank you. Anthony, I shall now come around. You stay where you are. Feel like Wilfred Pickles.
Really?
They remember Wilfred Pickles over here anyway. Give him the money mail, wouldn't it? Now to serious matters. A paper by David Wilkie, Howard Waters, both from Heriot Watt, and Siobhan Yang, who is not present, from Tankang University, Taipei. The paper is on reserving, pricing and hedging for policies with guaranteed annuity options. And I will ask David Wilkie to introduce the paper.
Thank you very much, Mr. President, ladies and gentlemen. The origins of this paper lie in the mid-1960s, when Sydney Benjamin wrote a number of papers on how actuaries could use computers and included the concept of simulating a range of possible futures in order to calculate contingency reserves for various types of life insurance. These ideas were developed further in the 1970s by the work leading up to the report of the Maturity Guarantees Working Party, to which Sydney and I both contributed and which Paul Thornton has already referred to. The stochastic model for shares developed for the Maturity Guarantees Working Party stimulated me to produce the first version of my stochastic asset model in 1984. In January 1985, I presented a paper to the then Institute of Actuaries Student Society in this hall on some applications of stochastic investment models. Sydney Benjamin, in fact, was in the chair. In that paper, I used a number of examples to show how my stochastic asset model, or any other similar model, could be used to derive interesting results. I did not use guaranteed annuity options, though they would have been an excellent example for my purpose. If I had, section 2 of tonight's paper could have been written at that time. I do not know why I did not consider guaranteed annuity options at that time. I suppose that they were not of topical interest then. In fact, the life office for which I then worked had issued rather few such contracts in quite a long time previously. It was not until about 1997 that the topic seemed to surface publicly. Bolton and others produced a useful, and I think too little publicised, short report on the subject that contained all the essential principles. Then Shao and Yang arrived at Heriot Watt University looking for a subject in which to do a PhD, and GAOs were immediately to hand. She completed her thesis in 2001, and this paper is derived from her work, though rewritten for an actuarial audience. Her thesis and our paper are not, however, the same. She covered aspects such as monthly premium policies, with-profit policies, and stochastic mortality, which we do not discuss fully, and we cover the history since 1985 more fully and use a more elaborate option pricing formula than she did. We're sorry that Shawen is not with us this evening, but she now lives in Taiwan, teaches at a university there, and has two young children, so it's not practicable for her to be here. The paper was presented to the faculty in January of this year. If it had been written solely for tonight's meeting, We would have shown examples at the end of 2002 for entrance in 2003. However, since the long-term interest rate, in fact, the yield on the FTSE Actuaries Irredeemables Index, was at 5.6%, almost the same as it was at the end of 1998. The results are similar, if one allows for some improvement in mortality since then. We might also have used the CMI's latest mortality forecasts based on the cohort effect. But all that these would show is that if mortality improves further, GAOs at any fixed rate are even more in the money, so more expensive, whether one uses the static hedging or the dynamic hedging approach to investing the assets representing the reserves. We included several concepts in this paper that were considered to be of general application in considering reserving for liabilities of any financial institution, not only a life office. There are three quantities of interest: best estimate, prudent reserve, including a contingency reserve, and fair value. Fair value lies between the other two and allows for some return on the capital that needs to be provided to set up the prudent reserve. Premiums should resemble fair values. They're almost the only market prices that we have. There are two approaches to the investment of the relevant assets: a static investment policy, as we used in the first sections of this paper, and a dynamic investment policy, i.e. dynamic hedging, based on an option pricing methodology. Whichever one uses, prudent reserves also need to be calculated with fair values based on them. One cannot assume that the real world will behave exactly like any theoretical option pricing model, any more than one can assume that it will behave exactly like any traditional deterministic actuarial model. If those who read the paper take at least that lesson away, we shall feel that our work has been worthwhile, and we look forward to the discussion.
I now ask David Dulloway to open the session.
Thank you, Mr. President. The authors have presented a very interesting paper to us for discussion today. In considering how to reserve, price, and hedge guaranteed annuity options, they bring out, in microcosm, almost all of the important issues that life offices face today. Well, at least those from a technical perspective. In the paper, the authors have adopted a historical approach to the GAO problem. They discuss how an up-to-date actuary might have addressed the issue in 1985, show how well or badly this approach would have worked since then, and finally ask how we might address a similar problem today. Now, this gives an interesting picture of how mainstream actuarial thinking has developed over the last 20 or so years, even if one might disagree on what an up-to-date actuary should or might have known. With literature on applying option pricing techniques to insurance issues, albeit not to GAOs, already published in 1978, our actuary would not seem particularly up-to-date. Regardless of this, let's not dwell on the ifs and maybes of the past, but consider what this paper tells us about the future and how we should deal with GAOs and similar options today. In my view, the starting point has to be Section 10, where the authors first introduce option pricing and hedging. Considering pricing first, and I must say ignoring mortality risk, if a market price for an appropriate hedge exists, then in my view this should form the basis of the price policyholders are charged. It may need adjusting for expenses, for other frictional costs, as I shall discuss later. However, it seems extremely unlikely that shareholders and other investors would value an option written on their behalf by a life office significantly differently from the price they could trade it for in an open market. And I think this should be the case whether the option is hedged or not. Now, even if a hedge does not exist, or a perfect hedge does not exist, it does not seem unreasonable to consider existing prices as a good guide to the value investors would put on those prices which are not quoted. In the case considered by the authors, prices do exist for products to hedge the interest rate risk, and they do exist for products to hedge the equity risk, but not for the combined risk. However, we can use option pricing formulae to take the available prices as input to suggest a consistent value for a GAO hedge. In this sense, and actually this is how option prices are arrived at in practice, the option pricing formulae are no more than a graduation approach to setting prices. I think I would argue more strongly than the authors appear to in the paper that such option pricing techniques should form the basis of insurance pricing in pretty much all circumstances. The paper seems to restrict its use to circumstances where an almost perfect hedge is available, though from David's comments a moment ago, I'm not sure I've interpreted that correctly. If we accept that these techniques are appropriate for price and for value, we do have to ask why offices would do anything but hedge when the opportunity presents itself. The authors make reference to practical difficulties of hedging, but to me they seem to overstate the case. They consider only dynamic hedging using government securities, while most GAO hedges would, in practice, be based upon a mix of swaps, swaptions, and bespoke OTC products. Markets for the first two are far larger and far more liquid than the government debt market, and the use of swaptions or a bespoke product would remove the issues around dynamic hedging which plague the authors. In reality, most offices have now hedged the majority of their with-profits GAO exposures, which I think we can take as prima facie evidence that it is possible to hedge. Indeed, the market has absorbed this without much turmoil, though there is perhaps one circumstance where this was not the case. Now, it may be that officers do not hedge more fully because they do not really believe the value of the guarantees they have written is as great as the hedging cost, or because to recognise the costs in their balance sheets today would be unpalatable, or maybe there's just more hedges than we know about. It will be very interesting to see how the new realistic reporting regime of the FSA changes this approach, if at all. The authors do us a great service in showing how the appropriate formulae for calculating such hedging costs can be calculated. While sometimes tedious, the techniques and the tricks of the trade are fairly standard and are relatively easy to learn. I stress relatively. They are even easier to put into practice, as many of the calculations have actually been carried out and written down in papers such as the one they're presenting today. And for with-profits policies, the calculations are easier yet, as the correlation between future equity returns and interest rates is relatively unimportant, as it can be picked up in an ongoing cost of bonus. Such an approach is actually set out by PELSA, one of the references in the paper, and leads to the ability to hedge GAOs closely using only vanilla swaptions. In my view, these techniques deserve much more attention from actuaries. If a hedge is not held, either because it is not available or because the office does not wish to implement it, as the authors suggest, we must ask two further questions. How much capital should we hold to absorb potential adverse deviations? And what charge should be made for it? These are the key topics addressed by the authors. In answering the first of these questions, the authors adopt a so-called real-world approach to stochastic modelling based upon the Wilkie model. They consider both a quantile, often called a VAR approach, and a conditional expectation of loss, or tail VAR approach, for setting reserves. The second approach, for those unfamiliar, sets the capital requirements as the expected loss, given it exceeds some appropriate percentile. The authors suggest the tail VAR approach is superior for various technical reasons, as is discussed in the papers by Artsner et al., referenced within the paper. Personally, I'm not sure I fully agree with this. The axioms of coherent risk measures, which are those referred to, are the main rationale for tail VAR, and are really designed to make sure it can be used to decentralise the decision to accept or not risk. It is not clear why this approach is appropriate for decisions at a company-wide level as to the quantum of capital to hold. Rather, it seems that the metric chosen should reflect the concerns of the shareholders, policyholders and regulators. Recent history shows, at least to me, that the occurrence of default will seem to have a disproportionately greater impact on people's concerns than the size of the loss given a default, suggesting perhaps that a standard VAR approach might actually be more useful. Now, other views are, of course, possible. The main point is that the risk measure chosen should be driven by stakeholders' views of risks, not by mathematical niceties. On this point, I would second the author's plea for a far greater discussion. The authors also question at what level capital calculation should be carried out, policy level, product level, fund or company level. I would suggest that as capital is fungible, only a fund or company perspective really makes sense. This does require an allocation of capital for pricing purposes, for which I would argue a marginal approach is required. This will almost certainly mean that the sum of the capital requirements will not equal total capital required. However, any other approach will distort decision making. It's important to note that a different conclusion would be reached if you were measuring capital as a way of budgeting risk, as Artsner discusses. One issue the authors do not discuss is the length of time period any capital projection should cover. Instead, they adopt the approach of the maturities guarantees working party, assuming capital is held until the policies run off the books. This approach has, I think, a number of problems. It can lead to results very dependent, as the authors show, on the asset model used. It can lead to conceptual problems regarding new business, and there are various other issues. In particular, strong mutual reversion will reduce the capital required. One other possibility is using a shorter time period, followed by a purported move to a matched position if circumstances dictate. In this model, the time period that is required is that to notice a problem has occurred and then to do something about it. Fairly obvious. And the something you do about it is hedge. This approach is very common in the banking world, where a 10-day period is often used, the idea being that you can close out anything within 10 days. If only the insurance world were so simple. It also appears to underlie the FSA's new realistic reporting regime for with-profits officers. Now, when practical, this approach does circumvent the thorny problems of allowing for new business, asset model features, and so on. Of course, one must allow for correlations between the cost of hedging following a market movement and the size of a market movement, which is not something the FSA's approach yet does, though I'm sure it will do in the near future. And it does require a reasonably liquid market. It would be suitable for looking at interest rate risk and for market risk, but it wouldn't work for mortality risk, unless we think the reinsurance market is liquid. Now, this approach leads us firmly down a mark-to-market accounting model, and here I agree fully with the authors that this is the right approach. Even though the market cost of GAOs was low when they were first written, such a mark-to-market model would surely have led to an earlier recognition of the problem, have led to hedging, and perhaps even to an earlier withdrawal of the guarantees from new business. The second question the authors ask is, how should we charge for this capital once we've decided what it should be? Now, the authors use a fairly arbitrary 1 or 2% per annum. We should ask, is there a more scientific way? I think we should first note that if we use an option pricing approach to set the basic cost of the guarantee, then this approach has already fully costed the potential loss to the company, even if the hedge is not in place. Option pricing formulae can be derived in an expected utility framework, as the earliest interest rate models were. In such equilibrium models, there is clearly an allowance for the cost of risk. As such, we only need to consider whether any additional costs simply from holding capital within a company, i.e. we have a structure question, not a cost of risk question. Now, the economics literature suggests at least two possible costs, that of double taxation and that arising from principal agent problems. These have been a major field of study in financial economics, in parallel to asset pricing theory, since Jensen's seminal paper in the mid-70s. It's actually my view that the 1 to 2% per annum the authors have used is probably broadly correct, but it would be nice to have a more firm rationale for them. In particular, the Nobel Prize-winning economist Robert Merton has developed quite a nice model of the interaction of such costs of capital requirements and of risk management for financial intermediaries, including insurance companies. The authors question whether mortality risk really is zero cost. It may be zero cost due to diversification, but the need to hold capital would give a cost from that point of view. To finish off, I'd just like to turn to some technical issues. It's very refreshing to see an actuarial paper that actually has some mathematics in it. Solving such problems really should be the bedrock of our professional abilities. I would have liked to see more details on the calibration of the option model. It's not clear to me that it's truly calibrated to market prices. Similarly, I would have welcomed more discussion around the issues of fat tails. Are they really necessary? How do you model them within a stochastic differential equation framework? For example, models used for option pricing typically don't have fat tails, and they may not be that important. Models used for capital calculations typically probably should do, where they are very important. How do the two fit together? No doubt, including these issues would have doubled the length of an already long paper, so I'm perhaps grateful that we didn't cover them after all. In summary, this is an important paper as it addresses, I think, the key issues actuaries will need to face in relation to pricing and reserving for market risk in the future. I do not agree with all of the author's conclusions, particularly around the practicality of hedging. However, they suggest a move towards a mark-to-market model that I am convinced will serve us better than past approaches. In the past, we seem to have dismissed much of the information available in the markets. The authors start to address this issue. My last thoughts go back to the historical perspective. What should an up-to-date actuary be aware of today? I presume that the logic, at least, behind Appendix C should be clear. I presume that the arguments for and against different approaches to capital should be understood. And the questions of whether modelling fat-tailed distributions actually matter should be old hat. I hope the remainder of today's discussion will, like this paper, help bring me up to date.
Thank you very much, David. The discussion is now open to the floor. And may I invite anyone who wishes to contribute to let me know of their intention. If you could raise your hand if you wish to speak. Two. Three. Now, this should be an encouragement to the rest of you, so that by the time these three have spoken, if you have something to say, then obviously the rest of the hall would like to hear it. Please don't let the fact the meeting is being recorded deter you from contributing. All speakers will be given the opportunity to see their comments before they are published. If time doesn't allow... Well, that's irrelevant, I think we've got that. roving microphones are available, but I find most people want to come up to the lectern. But if you would rather speak from your seat, just put your hand up and we'll get a roving microphone to you. And please state your name before speaking. So, Graham, would you like to kick off?
Thank you, President. My name's Graham Clay. I returned from holiday this morning, so I can't claim to have read every one of every formula in this paper. Paper I presented not too many months ago here, David commented that it actually lacked any equations, so maybe he's balancing the journal for me. I wish to speak more about the historical perspective in 1985 than anything else. Because I returned to the UK in the middle of 1983 after 10 years in South Africa. So I have a very clear idea of what a reasonably up-to-date with-profits actuary knew at the time in question in the paper. And it may help perhaps to allay any concerns that the whole of the actuarial profession, indeed the whole of the life assurance industry, was totally unaware of some of the issues mentioned in this paper. By way of background, South Africa had had a market crash in 1969 rather than the 1974 one in the UK. It generally had had higher inflation but rather lower gilt and semi-gilt rates than the UK. And my office was a major writer of immediate annuities in both countries. And you'll be surprised to learn, I doubt, that since Frank Reddington was still on the board of the UK company, we matched our IA assets and liabilities rather closely where we could, and if we couldn't, we did our best to immunise them. Consequently, perhaps, when I was responsible for introducing a new range of unit-linked endowment assurance products in South Africa in 1974, we didn't even consider the possibility of including a maturity guarantee. So the report in 1980 from the Maturity Guarantees Working Party seemed to me a mathematical statement of the blindingly obvious. Guarantees cost money, sometimes. And when they do, they tend to cost a lot. I don't think fat tails were very publicly discussed then, but the concept was certainly there. On a slightly more detailed level, in 2.3.3, the authors deal with mortality improvement. Well, slightly oblique comment there, but while I was in South Africa, I had persuaded our UK chief actuary, worldwide chief actuary, I suppose more accurately, to allow me to revise the South African immediate annuity basis. Now, we couldn't get long enough investment assets there to match the liabilities, so the formulae for the premium rates had a reinvestment assumption after 20 years. And after much argument, I eventually persuaded Ronald Skirman to increase that rate from 4% to 6%. Now, this seemed to me remarkably conservative in the context of gilts yielding some 12% per annum in a market where they had never yielded less than 4%. Dalton was the Chancellor of the Exchequer in the late 40s, but his authority certainly didn't extend to the Dominions. When I made this point, I received a gentle admonition from Ron Skirman, which, as usual with most of his admonitions, meant that I was still thinking about it some 3 weeks later. He pointed out that the reinvestment assumption actually covered two things. It related both to the absence of irredeemable securities and other suitable securities for matching long-term liabilities, but also to the possibility of future mortality improvements. So he mused about a recent update, and this is in the late 70s, to the GAO basis used by the office in the UK. He had been persuaded by some of his colleagues, one or two of whom might be in the audience today, to increase the rate of interest assumed from 3.75% to 4%. And in conceding that radical weakening of the basis, he insisted on strengthening the mortality basis. My recollection is that he insisted on a 2-year age rating being applied at the time, since the double entry approach was not really very practical in our computer systems. So I think the conclusion from this is that some, at least members of the profession and some insurance companies that they advised, were very well aware of the risks associated with both mortality improvement and the tails in investment performance. Now, I suspect that they would all have been very surprised at the pace of mortality improvement that we've actually experienced over the last 10 or 15 years. However, the office saw no particular need to quantify a specific provision because whatever the basis used, it was clearly small in relation to the explicit contingency reserves held within the valuation liabilities, let alone the implicit margins in the published valuation basis. Another point that's already attracted some comment is that in section 324 around the charge for capital. Factor H, if I can read my handwriting. I suspect that 1 or 2% was on the low side, even back in the 1980s, because by then I was, in 1987, responsible for all our non-UK operations. And our standard approach to the use of capital was to have a hurdle rate for the use of the estate of the fund earned rate plus 3% per annum. The UK was aiming merely at the fund earned rate at the time. And for our general insurance business worldwide, the target was the expected return on equities with a risk margin of 5% or 10% per annum, somewhere in that range, depending on the perceived riskiness of the business. Now, there was some fairly primitive science underlying these rates. It was looking at the return on capitals on a risk-adjusted approach that shareholders might expect to achieve. But clearly, there was a differentiation between the UK and the overseas business because the estate was a relatively scarce resource overseas and clearly a plentiful one in the UK. Now, a 3% per annum charge for the use of capital seemed to us relevant in the late 80s. I would say that since then, our target returns have all moved to being based on the expected equity return rather than on the fund earned rate. But the risk margins required continue to evolve. I think I will say no more on that aspect. I hope this scene set is of some relevance to what is actually a very interesting paper and challenging us as we look forward rather than back, as the introducer made the very valid point, how up to date are we now as to what is relevant for future considerations or around future considerations when setting our prudent bases. And I look forward to hearing those comments. I leave it to others to comment on the mathematics. Thank you.
During the opener's remarks, the name of Philippe Artzner was mentioned twice, and we're very privileged to have Philippe here tonight. And he was one of those that put his hand up. So I wondered if you'd like to make your contribution. Right. Okay.
The actual floor. Thank you, Mr. President. I think that this paper is most welcome at a time of Solvency II and at a time of change in international accounting standards. I will make two observations on two topics of the title: reserving and pricing. In section 3.4 of the paper, the title is Reserving from Year to Year. As you are, if you were like me, working for a revision of a third paper trying to be published about multi-period risk measurement, you would jump on the paper presented and discussed tonight, and you see that in 1980 there were words of reserving from year to year. I think it is multi-period, no doubt. More precisely, the text we are discussing tonight in section 3.2 contains the following. 1980, the maturity guarantee working party felt desirable there should be no requirement for additional reserves during the currency of the policy. So reserves definitely have to do with risk and its measurement, maybe its management. So what is going on over time? How to speak about these things? Well, we will try to speak of some sort of valuation or appraisal, to use a vague word, appraisal of a policy. As opposed to mainstream financial mathematics, insurance suffers from incomplete market. So price is a little bit difficult to state. Value, so appraisal, is vague enough. Now there may be room for risk-adjusted appraisal. And for this short presentation, let us to identify two reserves. High risk-adjusted appraisal should be like high reserves. And then we'll speak a little bit about what actions to be taken once reserves have been properly defined. So back to point one, appraisal of policy. We want some kind of valuation with a retrospective approach for the flows which have already been seen and some view of the future, like an technical provisions. So views of the future, we may go into martingales and concepts, and as well as people in financial accounting teach you that income is an opinion, cash is a fact. This morning's Wall Street Journal Europe reminded us of the following difference. We see here the cartoon about, yes, I enjoy the concept of wealth, but I really love the actual money too. So we'll tried to have an appraisal taking into account premium, maybe single premium paid at date zero, investment return, and at date T we want some appraisal, so we take investment returns up to date T. We have, let's say, no claim, the guarantee comes only at the end, and provisions at date T, the prospective view, the concept of wealth. Risk-adjusted appraisal is the topic of one more revision of a third attempt to be published on risk measurement. I will not be specific, but let's say that, in vague terms, next to your X of 0, X of 1, X of final bet, big N, valuation of the policy, valuation on the part of the insurance company, you may have a risk-adjusted appraisal, X tilde at 0, at 1, at T, and at N minus 1, the last date before final termination of the policy. And now the tilde has to be conservative estimates of the value of the policy to the company. So as action by the supervisor, either internal or external, we may have a plan that before leaving the business go, we require that the risk-adjusted appraisal at date zero be positive. Now, if we go back to the reported opinion of the Majority Working Party, remember the reserve, the initial reserve should not be changed over the year. I will tend to see that in the language of my colleague and myself as requiring a bit more than that. For this, we need a little bit of definition. We will define sigma of X, the first date at which the appraisal becomes negative, bad news, and then I allow myself to understand the suggestion made, which was not the one retained in the paper, but made at least, that to require that at any date before date sigma of X, which is a kind of insolvency date, at any date before, the risk-adjusted value to be positive. It's some sort of formalization of the suggestion in 3.4.2 in the paper. And there, this seems very natural, but with my co-authors, we had hit something like that, and after a while realized that there are some technical difficulties. So the big message is multi-period risk is rather complicated, and here is a little example of this difficulty. A brutal claim would be that a process of appraisal values for a policy may be accepted by the supervisor, either internal or external, while at the same time a richer appraisal process where everything is 10 units more for the company would be rejected. Sounds strange, this non-monotonicity property. So what is happening? Well, life is complicated. Let's have a little tree. The values above the node, the values in black, refer to the X process, the appraisal value. The values before the nodes refer to the risk-adjusted, sort of the reserves. What's going on? At date zero, you find that everything works well. The reserve or the risk-adjusted value is positive in green. Why? Because there is a rich 30 at next date and a small minus 4. We are in trouble here, but there may be a low probability of being in trouble, so that you cannot hope no trouble at all, so you would allow to go at date 0. Of course, at date 1, if the world is against you, you are in trouble. And in a first formulation, everything stops there. So you don't see this terrible minus 20, which comes a few periods later. So you don't even care about this negative red number of risk-adjusted value, because you know at date 0 that at date 1, the world is maybe against you. So you accept, because the idea is that if you see a possible insolvency at next date, and you see also on the tree that you would have been warned before, you don't leave the business go. But you are ready to accept situation where there is a trouble at some future period, but before, the risk-adjusted value is positive. So you leave go. You let go. Okay, now, for the surprising fact that if the contract gives 10 more units to the company at any, for any date, what's happening? The big trouble at date 3, minus 20, is a medium trouble now, minus 10 only. But the warning bell before, one period before, the risk-adjusted value, which serves as alarm to tell you stop the business or not, being at minus 12 plus 10 more units is negative. So with this policy, with this intervention policy, at initial date, the supervisor, either internal or external, would say, sorry, we cannot let this business go, because there will be one point where you are insolvent and you will be warned of this before. We don't leave you go. The mathematical explanation of this is basically that there is a very bad, very complicated connection between the first time of insolvency for a policy X and the first time of insolvency for a policy X plus 10. Things don't behave always linearly or nicely. Allow me to quote a former academic who is in some regulatory office on the continent, telling at this point, we need a good definition of insolvency. Do we have one so far? I will go faster on my last transparency about pricing. I notice that in section 2.3, 10 and 11, the paper quotes old, much older paper of Professor Wilkie, 1978, where suggestion is made to price a policy out of expected claim plus compensation due to shareholders bringing some risk capital. I find that very interesting as a connection of risk measurement, because the capital required, it's called shareholders' money in the paper, the capital required gives us a price for policies. It puts some light on some current debate or battle about the relationships between risk measurement and insurance premium principle. More importantly, at the time of Solvency II, I think that this consideration about pricing brings some light on discussion between should solvency be provided by more larger solvency margin or more conservative provisions. And I think we can thank the authors for reminding us of their some earlier work in this field. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Philippe. Did either of you want to just make a comment on that before we move on to the next one? No? Okay. Right. There was a contribution from the back. Yeah. Yep. Do you want to... Don, do you want to come up?
My name is Donald Duval. I wasn't going to comment on the analysis on the paper in detail, not because it's unimportant, but because I wanted to look forward rather than look back. And the paper is a fairly detailed analysis of the history and to some extent of how it might have been different. But what I wanted to comment on is the question of the lag between theory and practice and how long is it and how long should it be? There's a sort of implicit assumption in the paper that in 1985 it might have been a good idea if all Life Office actuaries had picked up the papers as then published and used them immediately. Clearly that wouldn't in fact have been a good idea. Most of them wouldn't have understood what they were doing, for a start, because it takes time to absorb and fully understand a new theory. And secondly, there are issues in the theory which are quite definite traps. The obvious one being the point in the paper about quantile risk reserving being incoherent, and therefore if you do it wrong and add up your reserves, you can actually end up with a reserve that is too small, which was, as I recall, in fact pointed out at the time, that if you use ruin probabilities and amounts of risk at ruin, you can get rather eccentric answers. So I think in that sense, to assume that theory should immediately go into all professional practice is inappropriate. Clearly, it should be made available as soon as possible so that people who want to and are able to use it for commercial advantage can. But the question, I think, for the profession is, at what point should we insist that it is used in our professional work? Actuaries are primarily giving information to other people on which other people make decisions. Actuaries themselves make very few decisions, but we give us an awful lot of advice to boards or information to regulators which may lead them to making particular decisions. And in fact, we have a very poor record of deciding at what point something should become into practice. The time period, I think, should be long. If you look at other professions, like medicine, for example, it is quite a long time from you see the paper published in the professional journals to it becoming the standard treatment, and if a doctor fails to give it, you, the doctor is being negligent. We don't really know at what point that arises. Is it, for example, essential that stochastic modelling or option pricing should be applied to all significant financial risks, and actuaries reporting on such institutions should include such things in their reports? As a matter of fact, that isn't the case at the moment. There are a number of very sizable financial institutions out there, insurance companies and pension funds, where the boards have not received such advice. And the profession is currently silent as to whether we think that's appropriate or not. I suspect, indeed I'm pretty sure, that the actuaries have given advice on the risks being run, but not in a particular framework of stochastic modelling or option pricing, probably in a framework of scenario testing. Do we as a profession think that is acceptable or not? The answer at the moment, presumably, is since we know what they're doing and we're not objecting, we believe it is acceptable. I find that a very uncomfortable position. As far as I can see, the only way we actually change standards absolutely is through the exam system. That if once you certain practices become unacceptable, if you try them in the exam, you fail.
and then 20 years' time, by the time you're actually doing the job as an actuary, at that point it's become mandatory. But it's an incredibly slow process. And, of course, in consequence, other people have taken the setting of standards from us. The majority of setting of risk standards and setting of fair value standards is now actually done by the regulators and by the accountancy profession. And what we do is simply calculate the numbers in accordance with the principles that they have laid down. Or sometimes we work out the interpretation of the principles. Whether they are the correct principles or not, we may well seek to influence, and we do very actively. We don't determine them. We've effectively abdicated that part of our professional responsibility. I think that's a great pity, and I think that looking forward, we need to work much more closely on that. For example, value at risk is a very widely used measure in the banking sector. Despite the comments of the opening speaker, I think its flaws are significant and in some cases practically significant, and conditional tail expectation is a much superior measure, and it would be better if that were more widespread. And I think we should be pushing for that kind of thing. So in summary, I think there are two things that I would suggest we need to do, and these are both, I think, essentially jobs for the Professional Affairs Board. The first one is the question that's already been raised, which is to look at what are practicing actuaries not doing now, which according to theory they should be. What are we seriously missing that is going to be the guaranteed annuity debacle of 30 years' time? That clearly involves drawing together both senior practitioners and senior academics to go through the literature and see what's missing and what's not being applied. I think the other thing that needs to be looked at is this question of basic minimum standards. What minimum standards do we expect in actuarial work on in the various practice areas, and are they consistent? And as a final comment on consistency, I would just say, if at the moment you ask what is the price of a non-profit deferred annuity, if you're an insurance company, you will get one price. If you're an industrial company where you're going to do it through the pension fund, you will get a much lower price, even though they are now identical in the sense of the credit of the company is clearly on both since the announcements of June this year. Actuarial practice, as far as I can see, is not yet caught up to that discrepancy. That's one, in one sense minor, in another sense quite fundamental practice, because it does actually go to a fairly major area of our current practice. So with those suggestions for a work programme for the Professional Affairs Board, I'll leave it. Thank you.
If I can just add a recollection of mine, I think certainly when the Government Actuaries Department wanted to introduce the resilience test, the first thing they did was bring a paper to this hall and count the pros and cons discussions afterwards and deem it to have been passed into legislation the next day. But there were a few objections at the time, I seem to recall. Who's going to speak to us next? Bill, you're next. I spotted you. William.
The name's Bill Abbott. I didn't come here intending to speak, but the previous speaker talked about a sort of work programme for the Professional Affairs Board, and in some ways this is not just the Professional Affairs Board. There has been talk of an Actuarial Standards Board, and something of this technical content I think would actually be far better in the context of a semi-independent or even independent Actuarial Standards Board than within the profession, something which could actually get things done quickly rather than to debate it endlessly and to get it through quickly and maybe drive a standard through, even though there might not even be a consensus in the profession. I think if I've interpreted one of the points that David made initially about setting up, I think about these things from an accounting issues point of view more than a regulatory point of view, but I think he was saying an appropriate liability to establish in the accounts initially, and these are the accounts, not the regulatory returns, is something which is akin to an entry value based on the premium which would be charged. there is a debate going on in the accounting profession relating to insurance accounting as to whether it should be an entry value or exit value, with the exit value being more akin to the price which would be would be paid to a third party, maybe another insurer who would take it over. And there is a danger about just going for an entry value which relates to the pricing, the premium charge for the policy, particularly if there's only one insurer who is charging a premium and the other insurer sort of is willing to charge that amount. It could just be that the insurer is wrong and that the liability shouldn't then be based on the premium. There's one sentence in 12.8 which caught my eye, which is right at the end. This says the option price is only a guide to the fair value if the required hedging strategy can practically be followed and then is actually followed. I think the last five words are unnecessary because I don't think what the company actually does matters in accounting terms. If it follows, it does its best efforts in hedging the liability portfolio. If it can't do that, then to the extent that it can't be done, full stop, that can be reflected in the accounting liabilities. If it could be done and isn't done, then that's a case for the regulator to demand an additional reserve. So in an accounting sense, I think that's incorrect there. And I suppose, finally, some of the language in 12.11, which talks about a contingency reserve, isn't probably quite the right language in accounting principles that are now being developed in that contingency reserves wouldn't actually be part of a liability. So I think it's just a question of language. I'm not disputing the what's being said apart from the way it's being said. There is, I know it's a phrase in scare quotes where it says the contingency reserves minus the expected value belongs to the shareholders. But again, the use of that language as to whether liabilities belong to the liabilities or belong to the shareholders is confusing. The trouble with saying it belongs to the liabilities, in some areas, that language means it sets up an expectation that whether it's the outturn is more or less, then it could introduce a one-way option for the policyholders. If something is in the accounts for a certain amount, then that is theirs of right. So I think that point is just one of language. Thank you very much.
Chris Rogers. Like our previous contributor, I hadn't intended to speak when I came here, but so I'm speaking off the cuff. But firstly, from the heart, I would like to thank the Institute for graciously welcoming me to the Honorary Fellowship. I look forward to the rest of this evening and to many other interesting and stimulating evenings in your company. Concerning the matter of the paper here, our previous commentators have pointed out that we're seeing really important issues being raised in this paper, and there's kind of competing ways in which you could try to value contingent claims, value policies which would have some sort of random payout at the end of the policy. And it's clear that the basic methodologies, the sort of idea of conditional, of just taking the expectation of the payout, can't be quite right. You think of an example. There's a share which is trading today for £100. Okay, it's got a rate of return, annualized rate of return of 20%, a volatility of 20%, riskless rate is 5%. So in a year from now, you're going to have something which is log normally distributed with all of those parameters. What is the fair price to pay for that thing today? Not the expected value of what it is in a year's time. The fair price to pay for it today is 100. right? Exactly as David was saying, when there exists a hedge, the fair price for the contingent claim has to be the price of that hedge. When there exists a hedge. But of course, that may be the case in an almost complete market, such as you'd find in investment banking, but it's very far from being the case in insurance, where you're dealing with extremely incomplete things. You're facing sort of the threat of things like AIDS, for example, which may suddenly kind of quadruple the cost of your life insurance policies or something like that. This is a very incomplete market. So what would you do in an incomplete market? How would you price something in an incomplete market? Think of the most extreme example where there's absolutely no hedge available at all. It's just a toss of a coin. So I'm going to toss a coin, and if it comes down heads, you can have £20,000. If it comes down tails, you can have £0. Okay? Contrast that with a gamble where you will certainly get £10,000. Who would prefer the first? Who would prefer the second? Yeah, I agree with you. This is, of course, just illustrating the simple kind of economic concept of risk aversion, that people would prefer to have a certain sum of money rather than a random sum of money with the same expected value. So somehow, you have to pay for risk. You have to be compensated for taking on risk. Now, in that example where there's absolutely no hedging instrument, how would you decide at what price you'd be prepared to take it? So you weren't prepared to gamble a 50-50, 0 to 20,000. You weren't prepared to gamble that for 10,000, but if it was laid against a certain 9,000, would you do it? If it was laid against a certain 8,000, would you do it? If I bring that price down, eventually there's a price at which you will jump. You will take that gamble, okay? I mean, if it's £3, you're going to take that gamble. Right. So there is a price at which that gamble is going to be accepted. It will be a different price for everybody in this room, I expect. And that's because everybody in this room has a different appetite for risk. Now, it seems to me that the sort of situation that we're looking at is a situation where we have to be able to answer questions concerning what price are we prepared to pay for taking on some risky gamble. I mean, not every risk can be hedged. We have to answer that question. What are we going to do? How are we going to take on the risk inherent in this gamble, in opening up this new line of business, in writing this derivative, whatever it may be? Now, in a sense, this is, if you were to present this to a group of economists, they would say, well, this is well understood. We look at the expected utility of your reward, so each individual agent has utility. If he didn't take the gamble, he's going to receive a certain pile of money at time one. If he did take the gamble, he's going to receive that pile of money plus some random amount. And the price he's prepared to pay for that random amount is the price that would exactly equalize his expected utility. If he was to receive that random amount and pay £5 and get exactly the same expected utility as if he did not enter into the gamble, then £5 is the price he's prepared to pay for it. That is the price he puts on that gamble. So in a sense, the sort of conceptual framework for handling these things is very well understood. When it comes down to actually implementing that in practice, of course, it's going to be quite a difficult issue. It's going to be a difficult issue because you're dealing with, the performance of a large company where you're not just talking about, say, one option or one GAO, whatever it might be. You're thinking about the entire portfolio of the company. You're not thinking about a single moment in time. You're thinking about the cash flow as time progresses. So you have to sort of be much more kind of intricate and computationally intensive. I mean, these things are not easy to do, but at least the principles are well understood. If you can specify the distributions of the cash flows that you are proposing to take on, then you can, in principle, work out A, what price you'll be prepared to pay for them, and B, what dynamic hedging position you would take as a function of the prevailing conditions at all times between now and the expiry of the option. It sounds like hard work. It is hard work, but the investment banking industry does have tools around that can handle this kind of thing, not necessarily very well, but they do have tools to handle it. I mean, I know very little about the intricacies of how you would make such a toolkit and how you would operate it and how you would integrate it into a larger system, but the principles at least are very clear. And I think these are things which we as a wider financial community need to bring more into application. Thank you.
Who's next? Don't all stand up at once. Any more?
My name is Ian Reynolds and I sit on the Professional Affairs Board, so I can take David Duval's message and I can tell him that we already are considering some of those issues. In particular, and if any of those in the audience have not already read it, I do encourage people to read Greg Taylor's editorial in the last edition of the British Actuarial Journal. He discusses the difficulty of a profession changing its guidance and its standards compared with, and he writes as someone who has both been a professional actuary, principally in general insurance, but not entirely, but also as an academic. And his argument is that it is very much easier in academia to challenge existing scientific methodology. It is much harder in a profession both to challenge and to change that methodology. And part of the argument there is that academia expects to put up new hypotheses, to challenge them, and to look at past hypotheses and find means of proving that they are wrong. But professionals work in an economic, a commercial environment, and unfortunately, one which is beset by another profession, the profession of lawyer. So if you change your professional standards, and the problem, and it's one that the Professional Affairs Board worries about, you find that the lawyer will come along and say your past practice was wrong, and therefore you are liable in one way or another. Now, I don't know what the solution is to that. I've suggested in a number of cases that the solution is to shoot lawyers on the steps of the White House until they stop. And when I made that suggestion on one occasion, they said, why not start with the president when the previous president was in office? So I do think that we have to be careful about that. It may be that the Actuarial Standards Board is a solution. I'm not sure, but I think we have to look carefully at that. I am sure that one aspect of a solution is to keep talking with academia, and I welcome the initiative that we've had for a number of years of giving honorary fellowships, as we have done this evening to Chris Rogers, to leading academics. And I hope that we are able to listen to them, debate with them, and that in doing so we are able somehow to solve this problem of changing professional standards and not leaving ourselves exposed to having the previous ones as considered inadequate or wrong, and professionals being liable as a result. I struggled with the paper. It was getting beyond my actuarial and mathematical competence. So I wondered what I might do if I was still sitting in my earlier job as running the life insurance business of a UK company. I thought I might ask Chris Rogers to join the board as a non-executive director. I also thought I might employ the opener, who I thought gave an excellent opening set of remarks, and congratulations. But I suspect otherwise I might have to look for more and better professional advice in one way or another. Well, there's one part of the paper that did give me some concern, and it's the issue I have with financial economics throughout. And it's the issue of the market price, and it is the issue of is there a single market price? Now, it does seem to be to me that value at risk is based on market price, but if, as a large investor such as the Prudential, you own 5% of a stock, is the market price of that equal to the value for which you could sell it? Clearly the answer is no. So I have a problem here with too much theory being based on market price, which I suspect is a bit of the previous speaker's comment, is in relation to there's a different market price for different people. But what I'm saying, there's actually a different market price depending on how big the holding is that you have. I have a feeling that there's a lot of good value in financial economics, but I slightly worry that on the basis of it using market price and using volatility as the measure of risk, that it's actually building on uncertain foundations. I just leave that open to others to come forward and see whether we can get better foundations for financial economics and for the actuarial profession and its standards.
Thank you, Ian.
The name is Bernard Bergman. I too had come here not intending to speak tonight. Until a few years ago, I worked for a company for which, for one reason or another, was actually a market leader in unit-linked GAOs. And when the GAO problem came to prominence, particularly in 1996, probably up to 1999, when the falling interest rates really caused problems, we saw particularly large increases in reserves. And we wrestled with a number of approaches to containing these spiraling reserve increases. And these approaches included such things as dynamic hedging, and in fact, I think it was during the 1998 Asian crisis that I actually lost faith in dynamic hedging, as I could see how one would actually shift the market when you traded your assets. We then moved on to swaptions. And again, one saw how the price of swaptions, when we got our first quotes in 1997, I suspect at a time when many people weren't yet considering using swaptions, how the prices of these swaptions escalated from the time we first made inquiries to the time that we actually considered purchasing these swaptions. They just escalated beyond belief. You know, things like volatility changes, which was totally in the control of the investment banks, were things which you really just had to take the investment banker's word for it. But one of the points that I actually wanted to make, which I don't think was actually mentioned in the paper, and that was whether you use the approach of the Maturities Working Party or whether you use a financial economics approach, there's some issues which perhaps aren't mathematical, which are equally, if not more, important. And these relate to policyholder behaviour or to the rules or the regulations that are simply out there. And I'll give you a list of four things I've jotted down here which perhaps swamp anything or certainly swamp any different models you might consider. Tax-free cash, an allowance you make for that when deciding on upon your reserves. I mean, that could make a 25% difference to the reserves you hold. Policyholders don't always act efficiently. You can't buy a car with a pension, but you can buy a car or go on a holiday with tax-free cash. Trivial annuities. From time to time, the laws change, and the amount of trivial threshold which a lump sum can be just given out as cash. Every time that got bumped up, you know, bang went millions of pounds of liabilities. Two other issues. Certain policies only gave the guarantee if you took out a certain type of annuity. Frequently, these were just single life annuities payable annually in arrears. Now, one company might have taken a more generous view to that, but again, by the strict letter of the contract, where do you pitch your reserves when you've got an uncertainty about the actual number of policyholders that are going to decide to opt for a single life annually in arrears annuity? And the final one that I wanted to make was, again, specific retirement dates. I think the paper refers to age 65 all the time, but we had policies that only gave the guarantee on certain dates. Again, one might have adopted a more generous strategy, but where do you, you know, what difference does it make what model you use when the assumption as to when the policyholder is actually going to decide to retire and whether he's going to actually have in mind his annuity guarantee when other things, you know, he loses his job and he has to retire, or he unfortunately becomes ill and he has to retire. These things swamp the modelling considerations. So, as I say, I have had some experience and exposure to the different modelling approaches, but some of these other issues perhaps swamp the model that one uses for reserving purposes.
Thank you for that. Can I just say that I think that we're in a spectrum somewhere between reserving purely for what's in the contract and reserving for expectations, reasonable, unreasonable, and unsighted. And things is definitely moving in that direction. Now, whether it's in the reserve or in the capital requirement is debatable. But I think whenever we say, should we just think about reserving for what's absolutely in the contract, then there's certainly some people outside who might disagree with that. So we have to be a little bit careful of that.
My name is Andrew Wells, and like I think most others, I didn't intend to speak when I came here this evening. But I would like to comment briefly, very briefly, on two points that have been raised. One is on the practical difficulties of hedging. An earlier speaker raised the example of, let us say, the Prudential, who might own 5% of a particular stock, and whether the value they could place on that stock was five times the value a holder of 1% of that stock might place on it. I'd raise a different aspect, that of, say, a very small life office who might have a complicated portfolio of guaranteed annuity options worth £500,000. Could they get an over-the-counter option, a particular set of options, to back those at an efficient price? Versus a very large life office who might have a similar, equally complex portfolio of GAOs, but 50 or 100 times the size. I'm sure that an investment bank might be happy to construct such a large, such a high-value portfolio, but could the market bear it? And would the cost to that large office of hedging their GAOs be 100 times the cost of the small office? On a completely different point, there's been something of a debate this evening on the gap, the lag between theory and practice. Academics might raise a new theoretical way of doing something. It's debated in this hall and in Edinburgh. Further papers are written on it. Some actuaries might start to use it, and many years down the line, it becomes a generally accepted practice. But legislation and guidance talks of officers using generally accepted actuarial methods, principles, techniques. And an individual office, an individual appointed actuary, has to consider when a new technique or when a modification to a technique has become generally accepted. And one can imagine the poor bedevilled appointed actuary thinking, oh, I've got to convince my colleagues. I've got to convince the board of directors. I've got to convince the profession. I've got to convince the FSA. Maybe too big a job for this year. And if one appointed actuary thinks like that, the office might be a year behind the times. If all the appointed actuaries think like that, this year and next year and every year, there could be a further significant delay before a new technique becomes generally accepted. Thank you.
Any more? Going. Okay, in that case, could I ask James Tooley to close the discussion? Thank you.
Thank you. By curious coincidence, my name is James Tooley. I would, like everyone else, offer the authors my congratulations. And I did think of an alternative title for the paper, a bit like the motor insurance quotations one used to see, "It's not rocket science, is it?" And that leads one to the fact that it probably was. You wouldn't have Goford's Book Corner if it was just simple everyday actuarial practice all those years ago. And while the practicalities of modelling are not likely to be dismissed, I think one should forget the option we're talking about was heavily dependent on longevity, a danger that actually itself has only recently taken rather more centre stage. There are others who are smarting from that. There are numerous blocks of immediate annuity business that, with hindsight, are unprofitable, just as these GARs are. Whether that actually just makes you up for the count for two errors rather than one, I'm not quite too sure. But perhaps less important when you're looking back over history is that what counts is the risks that were weighing on the minds of those overseeing the firms at the time. And I suppose one lesson of the paper is not to be too focused in one direction. And that's, I think, where the discussion with those outside the day-to-day mill and grind of life can be very valuable. True risk assessment, trying to think of all the risks that can bite, is actually very scary for those of us conditioned by our histories. When one talks of models, one often refers back to the Maturity Guarantee Working Party, but again, it's of interest that current models being brought in for with-profit business, for maturity guarantees, and that was, after all, the title of that long-ago working party, are only now moving from, if you like, development into production. They have cost various firms an awful lot of money, as carefully pointed out in a cost-benefit analysis in a recent CP from the regulator, a lot of money to get into practice. And bringing these techniques into actual production is no easy matter. Well, that's sort of, if you like, my take on history. The paper is looking at GARS in a unit-linked context. And it's perhaps that that leads the authors, I think, to conclude that hedging is unlikely to be useful in 10.6.11. I think in practice that arises from the practical problems of unit-linked GARS, namely that the reserve for GARS is partially forced to be invested in units itself under the close matching provisions of our legislation. That is deeply unfortunate and makes the quanto nature of the option, a fluctuating nominal onto an option of varying worth, far, far worse. Because by contrast, numerous with-profit GARS have been hedged relatively, quite, and in some cases very successfully. The paper then considers mark-to-market, or trigger resetting of capital. The thrust of regulatory development is to mark-to-market for the basic reserve and moving that way for the capital. And I think that thrust is going to be with us under a number of guises from a number of different regulatory or accounting sources. The prudent statutory reserving basis we know and love from the past, as it were, might use a different system, a mark-to-market system on triggers, where you only reassess the reserve after particularly large moves in what the market reserve might need to be. And I think it's perhaps the recent history of both mortality and interest rates that make the description in the paper show that method to be so lagging and so out of date. Everything was going against it, really. But it's not something, actually, that we should ignore, because while the paper is firmly stochastic, it's not necessarily close to market prices. And you get similar lagging effects, I would worry, by using historic assessments of volatility, so that any long trends in volatility are only slowly recognised through a reserving system. And that's really the problem, isn't it? One's in a model world, not the real world. You're suffering from market consistency or inconsistency. You may have an open market, you may have a very thin market. But these actual numbers drive real management actions. They actually impact claim values. And so the robustness of the results are deeply important and should be at issue for us. And it's actually for that reason that I would strongly support current market value as the driver of these numbers. Because at least that is some sort of firm base that can drive, in theory, management action to hedge out some of these risks. Though, as the opener acknowledged, if only it was that simple in the insurance world. But, if you like, that is our skill, and that is what I think we need to explore after this paper. And to add to the list of things that we could perhaps explore, I would certainly support conditional tail expectations, which is being touted, I think, in North American and international circles, because it sits very well with a desire to close out risks if the size of the failure that you're actually worrying about is uncertain. And indeed, if we look at that, we might even be ahead of our banking colleagues, which would please me greatly. Thank you.
I'll now ask Howard Walters to respond to the discussion.
Mr. President, ladies and gentlemen, first of all, I would like to
thank all the speakers for their comments. I've made copious notes on all the comments, and I have to say there are very many interesting points there. It's always gratifying to see that so many people have read so much of the paper. The other thing I will say is that, as happened after the discussion at the faculty in January, the authors will look at the transcript of the discussion and reply in great detail to those points made. So the comments I'm going to make now are just to give some satisfaction, if I can, to the major comments that have been made this evening. One of the points that came through to me, starting with the opener, Mr. Dulloway, was the practicalities of actually doing the hedging. Mr. Dulloway said that we, the authors, had been a little reticent there, and that it was not as difficult as we imagined, or we set out in the paper to actually do the hedging, and that many officers had done this. That is gratifying to hear. There was another speaker, though, Mr. Bergman, who said that he had tried to implement dynamic hedging, I think from 96 onwards, and found that it shifted the market and there were various practical difficulties which prevented him from doing this. So he did say that he was doing this in the context, if I heard correctly, of a unit-linked office. One of the other speakers said that the hedging was, I think the closer said it was more likely to be successful in relation to a with-profits office. I'm not sure that I fully understand why it would be more difficult in relation to a unit-linked office than a with-profits office, or if I can twist that the other way around, why it's easier for a with-profits office than a unit-linked one. Certainly the situation is different, but I'm not sure that it's that different. But anyway, this takes us a little bit off the topic of the paper because we were just trying to set out a methodology and how practical it is. Well, there are people here who will know more about that than we do. Another point that Mr. Dulloway made was that since the liability can be hedged, why would an office do anything but hedge it? And I think that's a very seductive statement, and it's difficult to come up with any answer to that other than, well, yes, they should. But I think we need to be a little bit careful, and this will tie in with some other comments made. I think I better be careful before I attribute comments, but maybe Mr. Reynolds, I think I have in mind here. Financial economics doesn't provide, I think, all the answers here. What has happened, what happens in our paper is that we take a financial economics approach in Appendix C and in Section 10 and say, okay, let us imagine that the market consists of three tradable assets whose prices behave in very particular ways. They follow some very particular models, geometric Brownian motion, Ornstein-Uhlenbeck processes, and we know they're going to follow precisely those models with the parameter values that we assign to them. This is a degree of omniscience which is, well, I hope making you feel a little uncomfortable at this stage. Now, given that we accept all of this, we can then set up a perfect hedge, provided we can trade continuously and risklessly, sorry, and costlessly. At this stage, of course, we're away from the real world, we're in a model world, and I think we would recognize that we don't have all the answers. I think what we do get from the financial economic approach is an idea of a dynamic investment strategy that may well help us to manage the risk. Not reduce the risk to nothing, but to manage the risk. And a good analogy here, I think, would be to Mr. Reddington's theory of immunisation, which I'm sure that many of us, all of us, will have learned while we studied our actuarial exams, which said that if you have a level yield curve and certain fixed liabilities, and the yield curve makes a level shift of a small amount, and we're never quite sure what small means here, then by immunising your investments or setting up the proper investment strategy, you can make a certain profit. You'll be immunised against any losses. Now that, of course, is working in an ideal world where you know the liabilities, where you have level yield curves, and any shift in the market is to another level yield curve, and that shift can only be a small one. The same thing, I think, is true when we're talking about financial economics. It's giving us an insight as to the dynamic investment strategy that we perhaps could be following to reduce our risk. If I can move on, Mr. Clay's comments, his historical perspective, I thought was extremely interesting. And I guess that working in South Africa in the late 60s with a market crash there, he had an advantage over people working in Britain in the 70s. But he said that actuaries are very well aware of risks inherent in interest rate movements and in mortality. And my experience, which is now getting longer than I care to admit within the actuarial world, is that actuaries really are very aware of these things. This is bread and butter to actuaries, which makes it perhaps all the more surprising that GAO risks, which are just a combination of interest rate and mortality risk, were not more discussed within the profession. I'm not sure I have an answer as to why that has been the case. This is something that David Wilkie alluded to in his opening comments. It's very good to see an old friend, Philippe Arzner, visiting us here in this hall. And Professor Arzner and David and myself have discussed his ideas on multi-period risk measures many times, and that discussion will go on. The reason that it will go on is, I think, because there is no definite answer to the problems that Professor Arzner was outlining to us this evening. And I think one of the things, one of the general points I picked up from what Professor Arzner was saying, was that in the Maturity Guarantees Working Party, one of the things they said, and I don't have the exact context, I may be quoting out of context here, is that they were trying to set up a reserve so that there was no requirement for additional reserves to be put into the portfolio at some future time. And that ties in very well with my actuarial education, which is several exam systems ago, but they change so often that that's in itself not a condemnation, of course. And that is that if you have a future liability, you should set up the reserve for it now. That, I think, is not the way that things have developed. We now have marking to market, where you are going to release reserves, strengthen reserves as the market moves. And there has been a lot of agreement here that marking to market is a good way to proceed, and there was general agreement in the faculty about that. So I think that the ideas in the Maturity Guarantees Working Party are perhaps being left behind a little bit in some sense there. I was very interested in Mr. Duval's point about how a profession moves forward in its thinking. And I think that that is a very interesting topic that could be discussed, and where we might even benefit from talking to other professions at maybe even the sharper end of practice, maybe the medics could have something to say to us here. Mr. Duval said that there are several institutions, insurance companies, pension funds, where stochastic modelling is not carried out, and I'm sure he's correct. We do in the paper, though, in section 12 of our paper, quote from guidance note number 8, where it says that if you have liabilities that will be stochastic in their nature, then you really should be using stochastic methods. So one would hope that these institutions that Mr. Duval is talking about do not have these kind of liabilities. Mr. Abbott, among some other people, talked about the Actuarial Standards Board. That is something of which I know very little. I know that it's been discussed. I hear that it's coming to the profession. It may well be the answer to the sort of problems that we have with introducing new technology, if you like, new methodology. I think until I know more about how the Actuarial Standards Board works, then, I have to reserve my comments on that. Professor Rogers talked about a fair price being the price of setting up a hedge for any contingent claim, if such a hedge can be set up, and that is exactly right. And in the case of insurance, then all too often, where we have an incomplete market, then the hedge doesn't exist. The economists, as he pointed out to us, have ways of dealing with these things using expected utility and so on. We have a certain amount to learn there, and we look forward to Professor Rogers' further involvement with the profession. I noticed Mr. Reynolds. I made a rather mischievous note here. I think he didn't quite say just this, but he said that we should keep talking to academia about problems of how we deal with new methodology and so on. And I wrote on my pad here, "and listening?" But I think he did actually cover that point as well. So I'm well, it was too good a comment not to not to include. He did say that he thought there was a lot of good value in financial economics, but there were some reservations. I think he's absolutely right. This is not to say that I have doubts about the value of financial economics. It's just that it doesn't provide complete answers to our problems. It just guides us, as any theory must. Mr. Bergman, I've already referred to his comments. Mr. Wells talked about practical difficulties of hedging, and he talked about also the difficulty, if you like, of a small life office with some complicated liability buying an over-the-counter option to reduce its risk, and what price would it get compared to a large life office and so on. One of the points we make in the paper is that what we tried to do was look at how a life office could actually hedge this risk itself internally. Now, an alternative is for a life office or another institution to go to an investment bank and purchase some over-the-counter security that will reduce its risk. I'm sure that that is what a lot of institutions are doing. That then raises the question of how that investment bank or that counterparty will actually hedge the risk. Now, it may well be that they have an advantage here, that they will be working in a different regulatory framework so that they will not have close matching requirements and so on, so that they maybe can do things that the primary life office couldn't. But we need to be careful that to be sure that these people are hedging the risk themselves in an appropriate way. It's completely analogous to a primary office buying reinsurance. The reinsurance is only as good as the reinsurer, if you like. Mr. Tulley, in his closing remarks, said that we, the authors, claimed that hedging was unlikely to be useful. I think that's overstating things, and I don't think we actually said that it's unlikely to be useful. I think there are some practical difficulties here, but I think the hedging looking at the financial economics and the hedging strategy gives you some ideas as to where you should be investing, how you should be investing your money. And so I'm not sure that I completely agree with him there. He also made a comment about when you look at the whole risk assessment issue, the full picture, I think I'm quoting you exactly here, is very scary. Yes, I can believe that. I think that leads me to make the comment that I think our paper leaves a lot of questions unanswered, and the biggest question that I think it leaves unanswered is how do you actively manage the risk associated with a portfolio of these types of policies? I think if I remember correctly, the opener at the faculty discussion, Cliff Speed, made the comment that we have here with GAOs a liability which becomes greater on the office if equity prices go up because of the quanto effect, and if it becomes greater if your interest rates go down. And it may be that there are parts of the operation of the office where you can balance things here against these risks. And that gives you an opportunity to look at the risk management on a more sort of global scale for the office, which is something that was beyond the scope of our paper. Anyway, I thank all the speakers for their very interesting comments. I'm afraid that my response has been rather piecemeal, doesn't do them justice. I can assure you that the authors will sit down and go through everything very carefully and write a considered written response in due time. Thank you.
It just remains me to add a few words of my own and express my thanks. And I'd just like to say I think this is a really critical and important paper because it's part of the process of, let's say, listening to the academics, but not only listening to academics, but to the lawyers and the press, to make sure that we do move with the mores of society and take into account the expectations of not only the lawyers and the strict reading of the documents that we have to reserve for, but also what academics, lawyers and the press are telling us about the expectations of our end customers, or as I like to call them, our begin customers, because we start there now, don't we? I take Donald Duval's little roadmap, and we'll certainly pay attention to that, again, as part of the process, we say, of how professions move on. And I think also we have to think about this balance between when something becomes generally accepted, together with the fact that there's no reason why any actuary shouldn't be aware of papers in the field or affect the field of the actuary and think about the application to their particular environment, which may be very different or may be different from what one might call generally accepted. So I wouldn't like it just to be thought that these papers and the changing mores were looking always for a generally accepted rule, which is then applied. I think we still need to exercise what I still like to call actuarial judgment in applying them to particular issues and particular problems. Finally, can I put in an advertisement for this wonderful course, which is coming up, for financial economics for liability actuaries. Anybody who's not done 103 or 109, don't just rely on your students who have. You have to be able to listen to what they're saying as well. And I seriously recommend that any actuary who's not done those does take out this financial economics liability actuaries. I do think it's not just something of interest. I think it's critical to our professional future. So let's do that. So it remains me to express my thanks, and I think the thanks of all of us to the authors, opener, closer, and all those who have participated in the discussion. It'd be very helpful. I'll fight. It'd be very helpful for those preparing the transcript of the discussion for the British Actuarial Journal if you could hand any prepared notes to Pauline Simpson or Maria Lyons at the back of the hall as you'll leave the meeting. So shall we now say thanks to everybody. The next meeting, sessional meeting, take place at 5 o'clock on Monday the 24th of November when a discussion on realistic liabilities and risk capital margins for with-profit business will take place. Please note that this meeting will also afford an opportunity for comments on the FSA's CP195, enhanced capital requirements and individual capital assessments for life assurers. You are invited to participate in drinks at the back. And I'm asked to remind those who are going to dining clubs, please don't leave it too late. Thank you very much.